talk about what Benny Gantz said as we broadcast right now. The war cabinet, Israel's war cabinet, has reconvened. What Netanyahu said, of course, they are competing with each other. If Netanyahu were to go down, it's conceivable Gideon Levy would become the next prime minister. But talk about what's happening within that war cabinet. Benny Gantz.
Amy, it's for a long time that I claim that those who want to get rid of Netanyahu are obviously right, but they hope that the alternative will be any better on core issues. On many issues, it will be much better. But on core issues like apartheid, occupation, continuing the war in Gaza, will be very, very disappointed. And here we go. Benny Gantz, who is the alternative? Who is the liberal alternative? Who is the dovish alternative of Israel? He speaks exactly like Netanyahu and would act exactly like Netanyahu when it comes to core issues, to core questions like launching an assassination, like launching a war, like using the military power of Israel. And that's really very, very depressing, that there is no alternative thinking in Israel and no lessons out of the experience. All the assassinations that Israel committed, all of them, never led to anywhere. Nothing good came out of them, except of the ego of the organizations who stood behind it. And here comes this Benny Gantz, the big hope of the liberal Israel, and suggests to continue the war, to make it worse, to go for a regional war with Iran. That's really, really very depressing.
Are you concerned, Gideon Levy, that what's happening with Iran now is taking attention away from what's happening in Gaza, where the death toll just continues to mount, over close to 34,000 people? Just the official death toll is expected to be much higher. And where the resistance was mounting in the United States, for example, on President Biden not to arm Israel, given what's happening in Gaza, now the House, which is notoriously divided, is perhaps coming together around giving more aid to Israel.
It goes without saying, not only Gaza is forgotten. Also, look what is happening in the West. Pogrom after pogrom, and nobody cares anymore. The army collaborates in those pogroms. We have videos from the last days in which the army not only stands aside, but many times take part of those pogroms against the Palestinians, and nobody pays attention to it. Not to speak, obviously, about Gaza, because everyone is now concerned about Iran. But Gaza is still starving and bleeding, and we shouldn't forget it, even not for a moment, like we shouldn't forget the hostages who are still there. But it seems that now everyone is only concerned about retaliating Iran. This would be such a major, maybe fatal mistake.
I wanted to bring back in Reza Sayah. You were based in Cairo, Egypt, when you covered the negotiations between Israel and Hamas in 2014, as Israel launched its assault on Gaza then. Can you talk about what unfolded back then and how it compares to the negotiations that are taking place, what, in Doha and Cairo now for a ceasefire?
Well, obviously, back then, what took place, as is taking place right now on a smaller scale, was the killing of lots of innocent civilians. But one thing that sticks out in my mind in 2014 in covering that conflict was the Israeli government's flat-out refusal to negotiate. There were so many instances when I was talking to Hamas leaders who were in Cairo. And in these instances, they would tell me that the Israeli officials who were supposed to show up, you know, for those negotiations simply would not show up. And this was something that was not widely reported by Western U.S. media. The Israeli government's seeming unwillingness to negotiate with Hamas. Eventually, there was negotiations, and that war ended. But in subsequent years leading up to this conflict, the cycle of war continued. But that's something that sticks out in my mind in that 2014 conflict.
I wanted to ask about Jordan's position in all of this, Trita Parsi, what role it plays. You had the United States, Britain, Jordan, France, all intercepting some of these drones and missiles.
Yes, numerous countries participated in the interception of these missiles, and the only reason they could do so was because the Iranians had given them 72 hours heads up deliberately, because the entire purpose of this exercise was not to inflict damage, but to restore what the Iranians believe is their deterrence and showcase their capability. And as Gideon said, the shooting down of these missiles were quite impressive. But I think we also have to keep in mind that there might be a different scenario in the future in which there is no forewarning of these attacks. And as a result, France, Britain, and the United States will not be able to prepare for and participate in this extent in the shooting down of the missile. And then, as a result, it's not entirely clear to what extent the Israeli air defenses would be capable of handling what would likely be a much larger barrage of missiles shot at Israel. So I think the Israelis may have also picked up that at the end of the day, a military confrontation, even though Israel, of course, is much stronger in Iran and certainly the U.S. is, but nevertheless will be very, very damaging to Israel as well. And that, I think, is one of the key messages the Iranians were trying to send. The Jordanians are, of course, caught in the middle there, because all of these different things are then flying over Jordanian airspace. And the Jordanian position has been that they're defending their airspace. They're not defending Israel. This is not done in order to necessarily help the Israelis. It's to make sure that Jordan asserts that no war should be taking place on its territory or in its airspace. That, nevertheless, is a tough position for the Jordanians to take, given the very, very strong sentiments that are now boiling over inside of Jordan because of the population's frustration with what is happening in Gaza and their perception that the Jordanian government and the Arab world at large have been helpless and not done enough to prevent this slaughter.
I wanted to ask Gideon Levy if you've been surprised by the amount of conversation going on between Iran and the United States, perhaps not directly. And also, I want to put that question to Reza Sayah, but where the result is you have United States saying they will not participate in Israel's retaliation if they retaliate against Iran.
First of all, I would say we always portray Iran as a crazy state, as an insane state, and it might be described like this. But in this case, it was very measured, very measured. I wish the United States and Iran would have spoken much more. I wish the agreement, the nuclear agreement, would be still valid, and we would be in a much better place and safer place rather than what both Donald Trump and Netanyahu arranged us, canceling this agreement, which was the best way to prevent Iran from getting nuclear weapons. The more they speak, the better. Under the table, above the table, behind the curtains, any way to talk to them. I still believe that every regime has its own interest, and dialogue is, by the end of the day, the best way, even if it's the Satan of Iran.
And can you talk, as you talked about what's happening also on the West Bank, if you can talk about the most recent news about the death of one of the most prominent Palestinian prisoners in an Israeli prison, died of cancer, novelist Waleed Daqa, who spent the past 38 years locked up for his involvement in an armed group that abducted and killed an Israeli soldier in 1984. Rights groups pressuring Israel to release him, saying he was in dire need of medical attention. Amnesty International calling for his release, saying that since October 7th, he'd been tortured, humiliated, and denied family visits. You've written about this.
I'm following this story for many, many years. I even visited Waleed once in jail many years ago. It's one of those horrible stories which tells you much more than the story itself. Waleed Dakka is an Israeli. He is not a Palestinian from the West Bank. He's an Israeli Palestinian. He, by the way, didn't murder. He participated in a group which kidnapped an Israeli soldier and then killed him. Some of them, he was not involved in it, but he was charged for murder and everything fine. He said 37 years for this murder, much more than any murderer in the world, in Israel, not in the world. He, in this period, changed his, declared that he had enough with terror, declared that he regrets any terror actions. He's exactly the style of leadership that we should look forwards. Those Palestinians who change their minds and leave terror as a tool. But no, for Israel, no Palestinian is good enough. And here in the last years start really a sadistic behavior toward him and his family. No visits. When he started to be ill in cancer, when he got ill, no visits, half a year now. They didn't even inform the family that he's dying. They didn't even inform the family he died. And now it's already 10 days. They don't even return the body and don't let the moon in their home. I mean, what is more sadistic than this? And what is more the face of this current government of Israel when it comes to Palestinians, Israeli Palestinians, or Palestinians from the West Bank or Gaza? Sadism is the name of the game.
And I wanted to give Reza Sayah the last word. In U.S. media, we don't often hear from people in Tehran. You're a freelance journalist there in the capital of Iran. You've been covering Iran's relationship with Hamas, particularly in the aftermath of October 7th. Could you expand on this and what you think it's most important for people to understand outside of Iran and particularly here in the United States?
Well, I think from the people's standpoint, the people here are resilient. Most of them are peace-loving people who do not want war. And I want to follow up on Mr. Levy's thought about how Iran is often portrayed in Western media to the American and Western audience as a radical, reckless, violent government. And I think a lot of thoughtful analysts will tell you that a radical entity, a radical government, would not last for 45 years like the Islamic Republic that has. And these analysts will tell you that the reason that they have survived for these 45 plus years is that they're not reckless, that they're very calculating and they're measured. And they understand at this very high stakes juncture that there are forces that perhaps Israel wants to bait them into a wider war. And I think Iran understands that that would be a mistake. I think many here understand that if they get baited into a wider war, it would be a distraction to what's happening in Gaza that has served the establishment here well by getting them a lot of political clout. And it would also potentially galvanize and unite Israel with its Western allies that have been critical of Israel and their operation in Gaza. So at this hour, they're waiting to see what Israel does if Israel retaliates. But history has shown that if Israel retaliates, Iran is going to be aware of what their response is could cost, and they're going to take a measured response. It's obviously a very high-stakes chess game and a lot of people anxious to see what happens.
And
in the
we just
days.
Have 30 seconds, but Iran's supreme leader, Ali Khamenei, perhaps the longest ruling leader in the world, about to step down, the significance of that?
Well, I'm not aware of these reports that he's about to step down. But obviously, if he steps down, it's going to be a significant impact to the leadership. They've been discussing how they're going to replace them. But I have to tell you, I'm not aware of
And I might have overstated it.
Okay.
Well,
yeah, I'm not sure about those reports. That would be a huge development, but I'm not aware of those reports.
Reza Sayah, I want to thank you so much for being with us, freelance journalist in Tehran, Iran. Gideon Levy, Haaretz columnist, member of its editorial board, and we'll link to your articles. And Trita Parsi, executive vice president of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. When we come back, jury selection begins today as Donald Trump makes history as the first former president to stand trial for criminal charges. Back in 20 seconds.
It's been a long, old, slow camp to get.
Avalanche by Maya Lena. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Republican presidential frontrunner Donald Trump's making history today in a New York courtroom as the first former president to stand trial for criminal charges. Jury selection begins today as Trump faces 34 criminal charges, falsifying business records as part of a scheme to hide hush money payments to adult film star Stormy Daniels in an attempt to influence the 2016 election. The payments were not illegal themselves, but Trump's accused of violating federal campaign finance laws because he failed to disclose the payments and recorded them as a legal expense, giving the money to his lawyer. Each of the 34 counts carries a maximum sentence of 4 years in prison. Trump's required to be in the courtroom while prosecutors lay out their case, unlike the civil trials where he chose to be there. He didn't have to be there. Trump's also facing criminal charges in three other cases, two federal cases involving the retention of classified materials and his efforts to overturn the 2020 election that culminated in the January 6th insurrection, and RICO charges in Georgia based on his push to reverse Georgia's 2020 election results. Manhattan DA Alvin Bragg may be the only prosecutor to try Trump on criminal charges before Election Day. On Truth Social, Trump's social media platform, he called the trial, quote, this is Trump, election interference. Trump spoke Saturday at a campaign rally in the battleground state of Pennsylvania.
They're all Biden trials. You know that, right? And I'm proud to do it for you. Have a good time watching. Have a good time watching. On Monday in New York City, I will be forced to sit fully gagged. I'm not allowed to talk. Can you believe it? They want to take away my constitutional right to talk. I have a crooked judge.
For more, we're joined by Ron Kuby, longtime criminal defense civil rights lawyer based here in New York, closely followed the Trump cases. Welcome to Democracy Now! It's great to have you with us.
Thank you so much.
So he talks about being persecuted and singled out. You're a longtime defense attorney. Others are saying, no, he is getting a kind of special treatment that defendants almost never get.
Well, I don't think either of those are completely true. One part of the special treatment is his case has moved very, very quickly. It's been about a year from indictment to the beginning of trial today, whereas we have thousands of young people, mostly young people of color on Rikers Island sitting there who don't have the luxury of bail, whose cases are far older. So certainly this case is moving on an expedited basis. But what Donald Trump is accused of is the type of crime that's prosecuted in New York every single day by the Manhattan DA's office. It has nothing to do with being president or a candidate or a campaign or presidential powers. It's just a sort of garden variety, ordinary grift falsifying business records for the purpose of committing another crime. And almost everybody who falsifies their business records does so to conceal the commission of another crime. You don't just wake up in the morning and decide to falsify business records because you have nothing better to do.
Well, you're a defense attorney, and you know choosing the right jurors is extremely important. And I wanted to ask you about the juror questions, because we know a lot of those questions right now. They're going to be asked about what podcasts and talk radio programs they listen to, where they get their news. And this is question 30. Have you ever considered yourself a supporter of or belong to any of the following? The QAnon movement, Proud Boys, Oath Keepers, Three Percenters, Boogaloo Boys, and Antifa. Talk about the significance of this.
Well, both sides want to weed out people who they think, by virtue of organizational membership, are really incapable of being fair and impartial one way or the other, either the prosecution or to the defense. Obviously, if you're a member of the Oath Keepers, no matter what you say about your ability to be fair and impartial, it could reasonably be called into question. And as far as I know, Antifa is not a membership organization. Last time I checked, they didn't issue cards. But if you self-identify as being a member of Antifa, chances are you can't be fair to Donald Trump.
This is question 31. Do you have any strong opinions or firmly held beliefs about whether a former president may be criminally charged in state court?
And that question is designed to weed out primarily the people who take the position that Donald Trump, by virtue of being the president of the United States at one point or another, is not just absolutely immune from everything that he did as president, but he's absolutely immune from everything he did in his life, period. And if you're that far off the page, then you probably should not be sitting on this jury.
Then 32, do you have any feelings about how Mr. Trump is being treated in this case?
It's another one of those questions where if people say, I think he's being treated unfairly, I think he's being persecuted, I think, you know, he's martyring himself for the rest of us, you're not going to be allowed. That's a challenge for cause in almost every situation. On the other hand, if you say, I think he's basically being treated fairly, he's being treated like everybody else, that's the answer that the prosecution is certainly looking for.
As you know, President Trump has argued that the judge, Juan Merchan, cannot be fair because his daughter works with Democratic Party candidates, and he attacks her online, which led to Merchan expanding the partial gag order. He didn't say you can't attack me, the judge, but he did say you can't attack family members.
Right, and Trump has repeated this, and his lawyers have repeated this over and over again by virtue of Judge Merchan's daughter's employment. He should be recuse himself, but Judge Merchan isn't an extremely meticulous jurist. He sought judicial ethics opinions on this long ago. He was told there is no conflict of interest. His daughter doesn't live underneath his roof. And moreover, Judge Merchan sat on the Trump Organization case. So he knows the people, he knows the players, he knows the lawyer, and he knows how to run a Trump trial. Just not necessarily one with Donald Trump present, but a Trump trial nonetheless.
Can you talk about now what exactly happens, what rights the lawyers have? They've got 10 peremptory challenges per side. What exactly does that mean?
A peremptory challenge is a challenge you can use for almost any reason that you want to strike a juror. You can't do it on the basis of a protected class, race, religion, national origin. But you can use it because I don't like the fact that this juror wore a suit today to sit on jury service. That shows a little too much respect for this process that we're denigrating. I want to get rid of that individual. But there's only 10 of them, and those are used very, very quickly. On the other hand, you have unlimited challenges for cause. And most of the argument around jury selection is going to be challenges for cause. But what Judge Merchan has done, they're calling 1,000 jurors to sit in jury service, unprecedented number. So anybody who at the outset after Judge Mershon explains the situation. He's going to ask for a show of hands. Anybody who says they can't be fair and impartial for any reason, he's not going to question them individually. You raise your hand, you're out of here. So even if 90 out of 100 potential jurors say, I can't be fair, that's fine. Then you have 10. Bring in the next 100, and you'll have a jury.
Okay. They're all, though, from Manhattan. Now, Trump says he can't get a fair trial here in his home city. Talk about that.
Number one, he doesn't want a fair trial. No defendant wants a fair trial. Every defendant wants a jury that's predisposed to acquit them. That's just sort of baked into the whole process. He certainly can get a fair trial. In the sense that you get rid of all the jurors who have strong feelings one way or the other about his guilt or his innocence. Remember, this is not a referendum on Trump as president, which would be, I think, a harder case in Manhattan. It doesn't matter whether you liked his presidency or, like most Manhattanites, loathed it. These actions, the activities accused of engaging in, they took place before he became president. The crime was committed before he became president of the United States. So it doesn't involve great questions of presidential power and authority. It's just regular old garden variety fraud. With a porn star or a sex worker added in to add some spice to it, and, of course, Attorney Michael Cohen.
So let's talk about what exactly he's being charged with. I mean, if you were giving hush money to someone, that would not be a crime.
Totally legal.
Of course, Trump is going simply to argue he just didn't want to hurt his family, so he wanted this person to remain quiet about their affair. But this has to do with the election. Explain that.
One of the crimes, the underlying crimes that the hush money was designed to conceal was federal election finance law. That Michael Cohen was basically making an expenditure. This was a campaign expenditure, and Trump covered it up because he didn't want the American people to know that he was paying off a porn star just prior to the election. And the timing of that payment is significant, having taken place just before the election. Michael Cohen is going to testify what it was for. There's going to be conversations that Trump had with other people that make reference to Stormy Daniels and the election. And I don't know that Trump is going to be arguing anything because Trump would have to testify to make that argument.
And, of course, he says he will.
Of course he will.
But he has said that even in the civil cases. Oh,
he always says he's going to do this or he has done that. And maybe when the time the trial is over, he will have said he testified, even though he didn't. But it's unlikely, frankly, from a criminal defense perspective, it's unlikely that he's going to get on that witness stand.
We're not going to see any of this.
No. There was a brief period of time, a couple of years in the 1990s, where we had cameras in the New York State courtrooms. Most people thought it was a fantastic success, and it helped legitimize the system. Most famously, the Amadou Diallo trial, for those who remember, was televised live. Everybody could see what happened. The powers that be decided that should not be renewed, except for pretrial performances, as it were. So we're not going to see the trial.
Can someone convicted of a felony become president?
Absolutely. There's no bar to becoming president of the United States if you're convicted of a felon. However, you cannot own a firearm. So at least if he gets elected, he won't be able to have a gun. He'll have the United States military, but not a gun.
And you have to be born in the United States.
Yes.
I want to thank you very much for being with us. Ron Kuby, longtime criminal defense and civil rights lawyer here in New York. That does it for today's show. Democracy Now! Is currently accepting applications for our digital fellowship. You can learn more and apply at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Sharif Abdelkaddous, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Taracena, Tammy Warrenoff, Tarina Nandura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio, Robbie Karen, Hani Masood, Hannah Elias. Our executive director is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, John Randall, Paul Powell, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Nogueira, Hugh Grant, and Dennis Moynihan, David Prude, Dennis McCormick, Matt Ely. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
Something curious, something cultural, something unserious, sometimes serious, something mundane, something every day, though not even really that. Tune into Typically Tuesdays, airing every Monday. You heard that right, Monday, from 3 to 4 p.m., your hour of quasi-cerebral talk and tunes.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM in Burnaby, British Columbia. Mm-hmm.